Ian Duncan-Smith, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Hi, Julie.
Hello there. Well, we've wanted to speak to you on the show for a very long time, and now is obviously as good a day as any with the latest figures. Very encouraging, largely, for the government. Unemployment rate down to 6.4%. Youth unemployment falling at the fastest rate in decades. It's all good news, isn't it?
Well, the important thing here is it's not really about the government, it's about people, and that's the whole point about this. The fact that more young people are now going into work, and this was a very big problem about 4 years ago, and more adults as well going into work at faster rates than sort of 25 and 30 years, is it's good in general terms, but really this is about individuals getting jobs, getting a bit more security, starting that first opportunity they have to secure their lives, and that's what this is all about. They're human stories, all of these, about people getting back into work and getting over what was really a terrible recession, the worst fall in economic output in Britain for knocking on the door of 100 years. I mean, it was absolutely appalling, and so it's picking up the pieces from that. Job's not over. This is just a start, really. And the long-term economic plan is about making this happen over a longer period.
There is some bad news, though. Average wages are down. There's also some concern about the increasing number of zero-hours contracts and people going off the unemployment rolls onto self-employment, but actually not earning enough to live by.
Well, let's deal with those, first of all, in order. Yes, we'd love to see salaries rising at a faster rate. The key thing for the government in control is to try and get inflation down, and that's falling. It's fallen over 1%. Since last year, food inflation is now falling. So these are positive elements. But, of course, we want more people to be paid higher levels of salary for the work that they do, and that's very, very important. But, you know, this is also set against the context of businesses in Britain competing in a global marketplace where a lot of other countries are in difficulty, and a lot of new providers in the Far East, etc., are being able to have higher productivity and lower costs. So it's a competitive world, but we do want that to happen. But the key point is, you know, if you're unemployed, then you don't have a chance to earn more. And we know that people who are in work for longer than a year, they tend to have a higher level of salary rise than those who have just started. On the zero-hour contracts point, Julie, you raised, we get a lot of talk about the zero-hour contracts. The point is that in the UK, zero-hour contracts have been actually a helpful device for people to obtain the kind of work sometimes that they need if they've got other responsibilities, caring responsibilities. And so whilst there have been some abuses, and we're shutting down on those by getting rid of those exclusive contracts, by and large, when we've done seen the polls from the ONS and others that have looked at this, they found the vast, vast majority of people on zero-hour contracts are satisfied. And a zero-hour contract is not a zero-hour, as it were. It's simply a contract that you can do work, but the number of hours may rise or fall, and that's the key point. And on same with self-employment, really. Self-employment you raised earlier on. Self-employment, the vast, vast majority of people on self-employed want to do this, and there are reasons for it. Some people prefer to work for themselves, and others just genuinely think that they will have greater flexibility. Some have got caring responsibilities at home and things like that. So these are the flexibilities that are necessary within an economy. But
you claimed in a speech on Monday a lot of the successes of the welfare reform, saving the government money. You've been the architect of this coalition government's welfare reforms. You've taken a lot of criticism for a number of the reforms, although there's also a lot that is very popular still with the general public. What is your motivation? What is your driving force behind these reforms? Is it about cutting government spending? Is it about reeling back government's role in the public space? Is it about saving taxpayers' money? Or is it a moral crusade on welfare dependency? Which is it?
Well, it's kind of neither, really. The real point is that it's, of course, you know, when you're in government, you have to try and make sure that when taxpayers, at the end of it, government spending isn't my spending, it's taxpayers' money. So people who work hard and try and keep as much of their money to themselves, they don't want to think that their money is being taken by the government and spent and wasted. So the first responsibility you have is to use taxpayers' money carefully. And that's really when people talk about reducing spending, what we're talking about is reducing what was a bloated level of spending that took place under the last government to a level that seems reasonable to the public. Nobody complains, of course, that support those most in need. Of course you do, but you want to make sure that the money you're using is used wisely. That's the first point. So my motivation is to make sure that we protect taxpayers, of course. But on the other side of it, really the truth is I have a real interest when I set the Centre for Social Justice up a few years ago, trying to change a welfare system that, for all the good laudable reasons in supporting people, had become so complex and so difficult that many people didn't understand whether going to work made them better off or worse off. And this complexity led to an entrapment, really. Lots of families in different communities feeling that basically work or acknowledged work was not useful to them, and many did decided to do cash in hand, not report it, and others just simply felt that they would stay on benefits. And so it's trying to get that right, the balance right, so that people always take that positive choice to get back to work, to support their own lives, and while still supporting those who most need it, of course.
You, though, have become something of a hate figure in some circles. You've been called extraordinary things. I mean, a monster, even a murderer, blamed for suicides of welfare claimants. How does that make you feel?
Well, the honest truth is I believe that I have to do these things and I have to change the welfare system, because if the welfare system was so fantastic and successful before, why, when I came into office, did we have something in the order of 5 million people sitting on out-of-work benefits? You know, we have a disability benefit, which we're trying to reform now, which meant that the vast majority, over 70%, you know, never after their first assessment were ever seen by anybody ever again. We had 1 million people parked on an incapacity benefit for 10 years. No one saw them, no doctors, no one came to check whether they were worse or they were better. This is not a system that was helping anybody. And I recognize passions run high. I don't normally respond to this kind of thing, but all I would say is, look, you know, it doesn't help things to take the view that nothing must change and the only answer is to spend more money, because that's not what the majority of the British public believe. The majority of the British public believe that welfare reform is necessary, and the honest truth is we do our level best at every point to make sure that those in difficulty receive the support and care and financial support that they need to get them by. And this is, you know, this is not an easy process. I don't for one moment say it is, but these reforms are necessary if Britain is to, you know, maintain its position worldwide and to be a great economy and a great country, as we must be.
Well, let's talk about some of those specifics. And you mentioned disability benefits. One policy in particular that's come under fire has been the under-occupancy penalty, known better as the spare room subsidy or indeed the bedroom tax to most people. Now, there are lots of people like me, and I've been very open about this on air. I support the principle that people in social housing shouldn't be subsidised by taxpayers to live in homes that are bigger than they need. However, in practice, this policy has meant that two-thirds of those affected are disabled, losing an average of £14 a week in their housing benefit, which to people on your income and my income may not seem significant, but is hugely significant people on no incomes. The reality is there aren't enough smaller council homes for those people to move into, so they're stuck where they are with less money coming in. Did you intend the policy to hit disabled people the way it has? Did you foresee that it would? And do you have any regrets about how it has actually been implemented?
Look, the first thing, let's get this absolutely right. You make this point, and others do, as though only this policy affects people who are disabled or declared disabled. The first thing is, the figures you use are figures used for people's self-declaration of their disability under the Disability Discrimination Act. And the fact is that all social housing has exactly the same figures. So this isn't just people with spare rooms. The whole of the social housing network, two-thirds of them declare themselves as having some form of disability. Now, let's say they're right or they're wrong. I simply say that's their declaration. There is no ongoing check. About a third are in receipt of something like disability living allowance, which of itself is a payment to help support housing costs. And when we looked at this, it was very simple balance. It's not easy. The fact is the last government introduced this same policy for people in the private sector who were in social housing. That is to say, they were on housing benefit, but they were in the private sector. They were not allowed to have any spare rooms. They were only paid housing benefit for that. So we had the same one group of people on housing benefit that aren't allowed to have spare rooms and another group in social housing that were. And I thought that imbalance was not fair on either side. And the second thing is, you know, when I walked into government, we had a housing benefit bill that had doubled in 10 years and was set to rise by nearly another 6 billion in the 5 years here. It is one of probably the fastest growing single benefit in government, and we have to get some control over that. Otherwise, again, hard-pressed taxpayers, people on marginal and low incomes themselves, by the way, making choices about the kind of housing they live in, would actually be wondering why they're paying more tax for people not to make those kind of choices. And on your point about housing changes, etc., this is put around, obviously, by those who are opposed to it. But the reality is there are a lot of properties around where people need, and the councils and housing associations need to work closely with their tenants to make sure that they're occupying property that they can sustain in. After all, there's lots of people living in large property who those costs of living in large property are far higher than if they were in a smaller property.
But if they haven't got another property to move into, well, you don't agree with Nick Clegg.
Acceptances on this one. Interestingly, the Home Swapper, which is one of these organisations, a number of them cover 70% of social housing. They estimate for every downsizer is matched with 90 homes on average. That's just one of them. The others are all, that's 55,000 one-bedroom and 140,000 two-bedroom homes on that website alone. And my point really is this. I'm asking councils to build in future the right property, to make sure they manage that. I mean, the demand for property at the moment is 60% plus want one-bedroom housing or flats, not the three and larger house, bedroom houses that are being built. So this has been about trying to get people to focus on, you know, making sure we establish a range of property. But I'm asking people to accept the fact that, you know, with councils, if we can move and get people moved, after all, you know, there's something like 250,000 people been living in overcrowded accommodation. We very rarely hear the case put for them. They're living often, you know, two, three, more to a bedroom, trying to get by, whereas they desperately need to get into a larger house, where often you've got people occupying houses where they're not
using
the
rooms. Can I clarify, though? I know time is running thin, Ian Duncan-Smith. Nick Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, wants a major overhaul of this policy. Disabled people exempted, tenants only losing their housing benefit if they have refused alternative accommodation that's been offered to them. Do you think he's right or wrong?
Well, I don't agree with his analysis of this. Interestingly, you know, I'm not going to comment on my too much on my colleagues in government. But
oh,
you know,
go on.
All right then. We were actually fully engaged on this one for 3 years, and I didn't hear anything from them in that time. So I was just a little surprised to suddenly hear that they'd apparently found the secret to this programme when we had discussed this in depth and detail.
Is this him playing politics then?
It's not for me to say that. Their reasons are their own for this. But my view on this one is genuinely, look, this is not about trying to be hard or harsh on people. It's generally trying to say, look, you know, we're not actually cutting the housing benefit bill. I mean, it will still be rising under me. It just simply won't be rising by the level it was rising before.
Okay.
You know, we're not slashing it. What we're trying to do is say, look, we have limited resources and we're trying to make sure that we match those resources to people's need. And I think taxpayers out there know that if we don't do that, they will be picking up a much bigger bill in the future.
A couple
years.
Of final, very brief questions to Mr. Duncan-Smith.
Yeah,
Atos
sure.
Work Capability Fit for Work Assessments. Atos lost their contract, £500 million early because of the poor quality of their work. Do you promise that the replacement company will only use fully medically qualified staff to make assessments? Because someone with a severe mental or physical disability surely cannot be assessed for fitness to work by somebody with no medical training.
Well, there's a balance of people that should see you, and that's the point I make. It's being seen as fit for work isn't always just a medical test. It can be. It is also a test, you know, you get people who look at your ability to do things as much as your condition. So, you know, this is a balance, looking at this so that you get the right balance in all of this. Once it's established what that medical assessment is, the question is, then are you able to do certain types of work? And that's where the assessment is meant to go. I mean, we agreed this. This was started by the last Labour government, who interestingly now attack it, but they did actually start this programme themselves. And we've had to make major changes to it. We've had a whole series of reviews, 4 independent reviews, to try and make this better, to improve it for people with mental health, to improve it for people whose conditions were not taken into proper consideration. So it's a it's a better review now. It's a better process than it was before. It needs further improvement. And, you know, I took the decision early to break the contract with Atos because I was not satisfied that actually they were fulfilling that contract in the way they were. So I hope to give you that guarantee that the next provider will be properly dealt with so that we have a better, faster, but also a better process that allows people to believe that they are being treated correctly and humanely.
One final question. Have you visited a food bank and did it change your view on whether or not they're meeting a need or creating a demand?
Yeah, I have visited food banks and also supply kitchens too, but I'm a supporter of people in the community coming together to help people in difficulty. This is a new phenomenon, really, for the UK. But, you know, I support it because I think it's important for people to be able to support others when they think they have difficulty. The point I would only make about food banks is they're not directly related to the changes. After all, we've been through a massive recession, and one of the biggest problems, even recognised by Trussell Trust now, is that debt and the aftershock of the recession has caused people into lots of difficulty. But, you know, the DWP has money to support people. We have hardship funds immediately available if people feel they're short. They can come and apply for those literally immediately in the department. There are crisis loans available through local authorities. We actually, for the first time, and one of the reasons for the rise in food bank usage, is that we actually advertise their usage in the department right now at job centres. That was not allowed under the last government. We do it because we want to work with them, and we think it's the right thing to work to make sure that people get as much choice about how they can sort their problems out. And that's important. So there is money for people who have difficulty, and they will receive it if they ask for it.
Ian Duncan-Smith, Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, appreciate you joining us here at LBC. Thank you very much for your time.